We are talking once again with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
All right. Well, we are rocketing, we're a month away now from an election coming up?
It's really heating up now.
Yeah, and then the ballots will be out in a couple weeks.
Yeah, before we start talking about the November election, King County Elections announced this week that they had certified enough signatures to put the Recall Sawant initiative on the ballot for December 7th in a December 7th special election. So about a month after the November election, residents of District 3 will be voting once again on whether to keep their current city council member, Shama Sawant. King County Elections estimated that it will cost the county approximately $250,000 to $300,000 to hold the special election. That's on top of the $1.3 million that the two campaigns have raised so far, with the Shama Solidarity campaign about $50,000 ahead of the Recall Sawant campaign in fundraising. Sawant was first elected 8 years ago, and she has won two re-election campaigns since then, the most recent one in 2019. So my guess, she'll probably win again, but we'll see. That's set for December 7th. And again, only District 3 residents will be able to vote in that election.
Yeah, and over the last 8 years, the demographics of District 3 have changed quite a bit. Mm-hmm. That's Capitol Hill and then east to the lake. And a lot of that area is gentrified. Capitol Hill itself has a lot more apartment units than it used to, which makes things more difficult for Sawant. Her big advantage has always been her army of volunteers. And, of course, doorbelling is more difficult with gated buildings. We'll see what her turnout looks like.
She's championed a lot of things that help renters, and we'll talk about a couple of those bills a little bit later today. So renters have a lot of good reasons to support her, so that's kind of weighs on the other side of the scale in her favor.
Yes, it's true.
Okay, so some more election news this week. There were lots of candidate forums, but there were two big ones that were well-publicized on homelessness this week. Forums on homelessness co-sponsored by the Seattle Times newspaper and the coalition We Are In. First, I just want to talk about who the coalition We Are In is composed of. It's got a combination of business groups like the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, Vulcan, and Microsoft Philanthropies, private foundations set up by local rich people like the Seattle Foundation, the Ballmer Group, Campion Foundation, Rakes Foundation, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And it also has nonprofits in it that provide services to the homeless, like Mary's Place, the Chief Seattle Club, and the Downtown Emergency Service Center, among many others. And also nonprofits that work on low-income housing, like Plymouth Housing Group, Capitol Hill Housing, Solid Ground, and the Africatown Community Land Trust, as well as some others. On their website, We Are In lists as their very top priority implementing and supporting the Regional Homelessness Authority as the main way to address homelessness. Okay, so that appears to be the one thing that they're really, really pushing hard on. They also have a list of resources on their website for people experiencing homelessness under a link called How You Can Help. Now, they appear to be structured as a nonprofit, so they have to be very careful about not lobbying the mayor or the city council or endorsing any political candidates or initiatives. But that hasn't stopped them from pushing very hard in support of the Regional Homelessness Authority. And, of course, they co-hosted these two forums with the Seattle Times. Now, on Wednesday was the mayoral forum, and that's where Bruce Harrell continued to be very vague in answering specific questions about homelessness and about sweeps, although apparently he kept saying over and over about things about how the parks need to be clean, right? And I have to say that this cleanliness obsession really presupposes that once a person becomes homeless, they automatically become some kind of a vermin, okay? it's becoming really icky and really difficult to hear over and over again. But that didn't stop Harrell, of course, from using racial equity language to try to justify the sweeps that that appear to be the central piece of his platform. And he again promised the impossible, that he would house 2,000 of the city's homeless population within a year of being elected mayor without raising any additional money for the city budget, except maybe by begging local corporations to toss in some pennies from their philanthropic funds. And so, even the Seattle Times.
Where are those 2,000 people supposed to go?
I know.
Those units don't exist.
Exactly.
They do not exist.
Exactly. So he's saying that as mayor, he would be able to build them, right, with no additional money, which Lorena Gonzalez has called him on that multiple times, saying, you know, no, that's not even physically possible. And even the Seattle Times, which loves Harrell, called his answers, quote, vague, and said he, quote, offered hazy details, end quote, which means, of course, that he didn't offer any details, right? He offered no details.
Yeah, and I sat in on a webinar that the two of them did, Harrell and Gonzalez, this week, and I was really struck by how incoherent as well as vague that Harrell's answers were. I mean, he's been on the campaign trail for more than half a year, and he's had time to hone those answers down or have his staff hone those answers down, and he just hasn't bothered. Yeah, I mean, you really wonder whether he's mentally all there. And yeah. I don't say that to be, you know, disparaging or cruel or anything. I just don't think he's competent to be mayor. And this is a guy who historically has been pretty sharp. I mean, he's a lawyer. You know, he's professionally accomplished. He was on council for 10 years. Granted, he didn't cover himself in glory in those 10 years because he was a reflexive vote for business interests. But at least he was reasonably articulate about it.
Yeah.
He isn't anymore. And I don't know what's changed. I don't know why in what is arguably the biggest campaign of his life, he's not better prepared, but he's not, and it's not getting any better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I really also feel the same way Job does, that I have serious concerns about his cognitive skills at this point. And so I don't think he qualifies to be even running for mayor. And in addition, I think at one point he said, and this was a direct quote from both the Seattle Times article on the forum and others. He said, quote, we shouldn't have to look at the human suffering of other people. And that's my attitude going in, that I will bring to the mayor's office, end quote. And
oh, my God,
when you say something like that, you're really echoing the philosophy of the very rich, right, which allows them to sleep soundly at night as long as the poor are out of sight and out of mind. There's a problem with that kind of a philosophy, and he apparently doesn't see the problem, and the folks who support him don't see a problem with that, that as long as the homeless are out of sight and the parks are clean, everything's good.
Now, in fairness, that has been the focus of Seattle's homelessness policy for like the last 20 years.
Yeah.
Is just to push them out of sight and everything will be fine.
Yeah, they'll go away.
We don't care where they go as long as it's away. Mm-hmm. And so you get this ridiculous game of whack-a-mole where you engage in sweeps because, you know, an encampment was visible and therefore a blight. And therefore a public health problem, because as Maria mentioned, homeless people are by definition vermin. And you know, it doesn't solve anything because those people still have to live. They still have to go somewhere.
They just end up a few blocks down the street.
Many of them die, but that's not ostensibly the point of the mm-hmm. of the policy. The point is just to get them out of sight, which has not worked. And anybody can see, emphasis on see, that it has not worked. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think Harrell is as near as he can articulate his policy. It's basically to double down on all the policies that haven't worked for the last 20 years.
Yeah. And seeing the very poor and the homeless is really the first step in addressing the root causes of poverty, right? But you have to care about them. And you have to do your homework, which Harold has not done. So we get these repeated mentions on the campaign trail where he keeps calling for more data and more studies and more data and more studies. Well, there have been plenty of studies and plenty of data. It's just he doesn't know about them.
Yeah. And, you know, you have to have empathy also.
Yeah.
Which he demonstrated many, many times back when he had cognitive skills on city council that he didn't have that anyway. And that certainly hasn't blossomed in his later years. It's certainly not evident on the campaign trail. So, yeah.
Yeah. So Gonzalez, on the other hand, said things like, as mayor, my goal is to end homelessness, not hide it, which was a very nice thing to hear, actually. And she said that her first step would be to send outreach workers to assess the needs of every single person living in an encampment in Seattle and get a service plan for each person living on the streets. She was also, and that may be a very difficult thing to do and a heavy lift, but I think it is the first step, right, in addressing people's needs. Now, she was also focused on the reason for homelessness, the housing affordability crisis. So she talked in broader terms about changing the 80% of Seattle that is zoned exclusively for single-family residences so that more apartments can be built in more areas of the city. Gonzalez cited the need for 37,000 new affordable housing units in King County to address the county's homelessness crisis. There's a study there behind that number that Bruce Harrell should know about, but apparently doesn't know about. Gonzalez also talked about her co-sponsorship of the city council's jumpstart business tax on payrolls, which is meant primarily to build affordable housing. And we'll talk a little bit about that later on today. Harrell is against changing the zoning in Seattle, arguing that there's plenty of land available for new apartments, which would only be true if every single person living on an upzoned parcel of land were to sell their land and house today to a developer. That's that capacity's there, but, you know, in the real world, it's not. Okay. And, Harrell repeated the falsehood that the only way, or even the best way, for a family of color to build wealth is through home ownership, right? And that might have been true 50 or 60 years ago, but we just don't live in that world anymore where every single person can own a house with a garage, a front yard, and a backyard. For one thing, the planet simply can't tolerate that, right? And the human race isn't going to survive if we keep going down the path that we're on in terms of climate destruction and land degradation. So this idea that we're all still living in the 1950s or 1960s where, you know, the natural course for everyone is to get married, have two kids, buy a house in the suburbs is just not the modern world anymore.
And that was never an ideal world for a lot of people to begin with. And Harrell doesn't seem aware of that either. He's
right.
Holding it up as an ideal when it was not an ideal era for a lot of people, including, I might add, you know, mm-hmm. Harrell is part Asian, and Asians couldn't own land in Seattle and in Washington State until 1960.
Yeah.
You know, the Asian land laws were still in effect. So, you know.
But I should point out, too, that Harrell is a landlord. He owns lots of properties around Seattle. So, yeah, building wealth, that's what, by buying land, he knows what that's all about, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so
And one wonders how he got that wealth, you know, from a decade on city council, but I digress.
Anyway, so let's talk a little bit about the other candidate for him on homelessness for Council Position 9. Again, the Seattle Times and We Are In hosted a forum for the candidates for Council Position 9, which are Sarah Nelson and Nikita Oliver. Excuse me. Sarah Nelson again seemed very out of touch, unaware of what the city council has been trying to do already to address homelessness. When asked what she would do to get more very low income housing built in Seattle, she initially said that that's what affordable housing providers do. And so it's really not her job, I guess, which Which means she doesn't know what the city council actually does, in spite of having worked for former council member Richard Conlon. Right?
Yeah. Well, if I had to pick a council member for whom an aide wouldn't know what the council actually does, that would be the guy. Yeah, so, yeah, anyway.
Yeah, Conlon, yeah. So Nikita Oliver, on the other hand, spoke in favor of both changing zoning in Seattle and getting more progressive revenue into the city budget for affordable housing. Oliver suggested working with co-ops, community land trusts, nonprofits, and putting in place strategic incentives for developers. So clearly Oliver knows something about how the city council functions, unlike Nelson. Weirdly, Nelson openly contradicted herself, at one point saying that before we raise taxes and find more revenue for affordable housing, the city should first have a plan and figure out how much it will cost to address homelessness and affordable housing issues. But then later on in said that the city shouldn't make any plans because it will all be up to the regional authority anyway. So I guess that's why she thinks that it's not that homelessness and housing is just not something she would have to address as a city council member.
And you know, that's why you can't raise taxes, because why raise taxes to spend money when the city can't spend money anyway because it's all up to the regional authorities?
Yeah. Oliver, on the other hand, recognized both that the city council will be providing nearly all of the money for the regional homelessness authority. So, yes, raise taxes, right? And that the city will still have to provide some kind of services outside of the regional authority, as well as funding for affordable housing so homeless people have a place to go to in order to get permanently housed once they've entered the shelter system, right? Getting people into shelter is just the first step. Nelson seemed really unclear about that entire process. And for that reason, I think she did rather poorly in the forum.
Anything else on that?
Nope. I just thought it would be very useful to summarize those two and to let people know that there are a lot more candidate forums coming up that if you get a chance, it's definitely worth sitting in on those, particularly the mayoral forum, to get a real feel for which one of the two candidates is more competent than the other.
Well, moving on, the Port of Seattle fired one of their employees this week.
Yeah, this falls under the cops behaving badly department, which we always seem to have a couple of items for each week. The Port of Seattle fired its police chief, a guy named Rod Covey. He has been suspended since June for what the port says are unspecified violations of its personnel policies. Now, this likely has something to do with a lawsuit that was filed against the port by an African-American employee alleging racial discrimination on behalf of Covey. The Port of Seattle's police department is overwhelmingly white and has tried and really failed over the last several years to diversify. So this almost certainly what has to do with racial justice. And has to do with the port having not followed through in the past on its, you know, stated commitment to diversifying its police force.
Thing to have that stated as a policy and another to really follow through. And the follow through really comes from the top, right? And if the person at the top makes it a priority, it happens. And if they don't care, it never happens.
Yes. And on a related note, there was an excellent investigative piece in the Seattle Times this week about the Washington State Patrol's hiring policies. It turns out that the Washington State Patrol has also been a dismal failure in trying to diversify its ranks. But this is for a different reason. It's had plenty of applicants. It has recruited plenty of applicants of color, but they always seem to fail the psych evaluation that, potential recruits have to go through in order to enroll in the academy and be trained to be a Washington State Patrol person. This goes down to one person who's the chief psychiatrist for the Washington State Patrol, of whom there have been a number of complaints that he is racially biased. And he seems to disqualify applicants of color at a wildly disproportionate rate to his disqualifications of white applicants. This is the main reason, apparently, why the Washington State Patrol has failed to diversify over the last 20 years or so that has had that as a stated goal. And it really points to not just the person at the top, but understanding how, you know, bureaucrats in the middle of the process can also be a huge impediment to creating a culture of diversity. We've seen this in SPD also, where, you know, just because there has been a reform process does not mean that the fundamental culture of SPD has changed. It really hasn't. And that's been a huge problem in terms of how it treats communities of color, whether it's trusted by communities of color, you know, use of force policies, how it treats protesters. You know, you can go right on down the line. You know, scene commanders have a lot to do with that. And if the scene commanders are an issue and they're not being held accountable within the system, then it it doesn't change. And this is what we've seen in SPD. So we've seen in King County Sheriff's Office. We've seen it in a number of different local law enforcement agencies. And that apparently is true now also for the Washington State Patrol, as well as the Port of Seattle's police force.
Yeah, specifically the screening, from my reading, rejected 20% of white candidates compared to 33% of black candidates, 35% of Hispanic candidates, and 41% of Asian candidates. So,
yeah, I didn't have those numbers in front of me, so thank you.
And I also wanted to point out, Covey has been on desk duty at the Port of Seattle on desk duty since June of 2020. So he's been sitting there for quite a while.
Yeah, and that's when the lawsuit was filed as well. There's been an investigation since then. And the person who's been acting chief since June of 2020 will take over as acting chief and continue in that role while they look for a permanent replacement.
All right. So, tangential to all this, Carolyn Bick at the South Seattle Emerald.
Again, she had a really good piece of reporting this week, and you can still find it on the website of the South Seattle Emerald. It was about glaring discrepancies in the Office of Police Accountability's report on what happened when the police attacked the crowd of peaceful demonstrators at last year's Labor Day protest, which was held near the SPOG Guild, the Seattle Police Officers Guild headquarters in South Seattle.
I remember that vividly.
I remember watching it.
It was live streamed at the time, and the live streamers were actually singled out and attacked by SPD along with protesters.
I highly recommend that you read her article on it. It paints a picture of an agency, the OPA, that's more concerned with excusing the bad behavior of Seattle police officers than fulfilling the oversight duty that it has under city law. Now, Bick details several contradictions and outright errors in the OPA's report that's obviously contradicted by both live stream video and by officers' body cam video of that day. In addition, she notes that Andrew Meyerberg, the head of the OPA, seems to have lied to her in June of this year when he told her that the final report had not been issued, when in fact the report that she reviewed and wrote her article about appears to have been finalized in April of this year, almost 3 months before Meyerberg told her that it wasn't a final report. Okay. Bick finds so many inaccuracies within that report that it appears the OPA is intent on propagating a fictional narrative of what happened on that day and how the police treated the crowd during that Labor Day protest last year. One of the more, and I'm not going to go into all the details because they're laid out very, very well in that article. So definitely look for it on the website of the South Seattle Emerald. One of the more damning findings within the report is that Seattle bicycle cops are actually trained to use their bikes as assault weapons against protesters. And of course, the OPA saw nothing wrong with that in their report. This is essentially, I think, the icing on the cake, because the OPA has been letting SPD officers off the hook for more than a year now in their review and investigation of complaints related to all of last year's George Floyd protests. It's clear and, that
backing up, you know, Seattle bike officers have used their bikes as weapons for crowd control for literally a couple decades.
Yeah.
And there have been any number of complaints, and those complaints are never sustained because it's just fine, apparently, to use your bike as a weapon, even though it would be assault if you were doing it as a private citizen.
Yeah. Now, Seattle Police Department policy says that bike officers, when they're meant to play a role in crowd control, are supposed to stop their advancing line before they make contact with the crowd, when in fact the report details multiple instances and says that this is part of SPD training, that bike officers ride their bikes right up onto people's legs. Mm-hmm. They ride just to bump and to ride right up onto your legs to cause bruising and pain and abrasions and so forth in order to intimidate and assault crowds. In addition, bicycle officers, at least a couple of bicycle officers are singled out for having slammed their bikes into people, hitting people with their bikes, and the OPA didn't find that a problem. So I think it's really clear that the Office of Police Accountability is not an oversight body. They're really just a good old boys club intent on boosting the morale of the Seattle Police Department, and that's a problem. And I think it should be brought up to the court monitor.
And to the new mayor, whoever that is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll see who our new mayor is come November. And if those kind of tactics change at the Seattle Police Department. So definitely check out that article. That was the South Seattle Emerald website, an article by Carolyn Bick. And I think the publication date was September 27th. So look for that.
And she has been doing outstanding work for a couple of years now. She's one of our best local reporters. So definitely seek her stuff out in general.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on to this week's council-related news.
Yeah, first I want to talk about those two bills that I mentioned earlier. On Monday, the City Council passed two bills to provide more protections for renters. These were both bills that had been proposed by Shama Sawant. The first one will require landlords to provide at least 6 months' notice of a rent increase before they can jack up your rent, which is great, actually, for renters. It allows you time to find a new apartment in a tight, very tight housing market if you need to move. Now, the second bill.
I found the alarmed headline in the Seattle Times quite amusing, by the way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The oh my God, this is going to destroy landlords.
Yeah, exactly. And that was really the gist of the article. And it's like, you know, how many people reading this article are landlords and how many are renters? You know, they don't seem to care who their audience is, or maybe they do care who their audience is.
Well, the interesting thing is we saw the same headlines when Seattle first passed the, you know, 60-day requirement. You have to give 60 days notice to tenants before you jack up their rent. You know, it was all the same stuff about how, oh, this is going to destroy landlords, right?
They seem to be doing okay still. Yeah.
Yeah, they do. Now, the second bill that passed the City Council will help renters who make less than 80% of area median income, which in Seattle is $64,790 for a single person or $92,560 for a family of four. If their landlord increases the rent more than 10%, the tenant will qualify to receive relocation assistance from their landlord equal to 3 months of their current rent. This should help the tenant pay for first month's rent, last month's rent, and a security deposit if they have to move. Now, it should also have the effect of holding most rent increases down to under 10%, which is awesome news. Now, the first bill passed by a 7-1 vote, with Alex Peterson voting no and Deborah Juarez absent on Monday. The second bill passed unanimously, which is very interesting because I know there are several homeowners on the city council who are probably appalled by the idea of a 10% or more rental increase. But I have to say that that's really common in Seattle. And as a renter, I've seen it more than once. Okay. Of a landlord coming to me and saying, you know, your rental increase is going to be more than 10% this year. In fact, I had one landlord tell me he wanted to increase my rent by almost 30%. So, of course, I moved. And that's really the only thing you can do in that kind of a situation. And fortunately, I had the cash savings on hand to afford to move. But there are many, many people who don't have much of any cash savings. So when a landlord comes to them and says, hey, we're jacking up your rent 30%, what can they do, right? So now there's something that they can do. They can get tenant relocation assistance from the landlord equal to 3 months rent. But I think what's going to happen is that landlords are going to be keeping their annual rental increases under 10%.
Yeah, 9.995.
Exactly. But remember too, an annual increase every year of 9% adds up to a lot over time. So this
yeah,
is not
it compounds. Yeah.
Yeah. Even though once again, landlords and the Seattle Times were freaking out going, this is rent control. This is rent control. It's not rent control.
It'd be nice if we had rent control, but mm-hmm. It's not rent control.
Yeah. It's not rent control. Okay. So also this week, Mayor Durkan released her draft city budget for 2022, and it's something that we're going to be talking a lot about in the next few weeks. She's done the same thing with this budget this year that she's done in prior years. Durkan has shifted funding around to obscure her priorities and to cut several programs that the city council meant to be permanent programs, including money for existing diversion programs that the council has wanted to expand, not to cut completely, which is, you know, it's kind of a slap when a mayor releases a budget that just doesn't fund programs that the city council continues to add back to the budget year after year after year.
And so now we'll go through this tedious cycle of the council looking at the budget and restoring funding for the programs that it wants and cutting money to Durkan's pet projects in order to pay for it.
Any of which are new.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and so that'll get signed into law, and then Durkan won't spend the money as allocated.
Durkan won't be in office in yes, 2022, which is another part of the reason why this budget makes no sense. It's like, why would you rewrite the budget to this extent when you're not even going to be in office next year?
Yeah.
Now, Durkan has also grabbed, and this is particularly bad, Durkan has also grabbed over $100 million out of the Jumpstart payroll tax funds to make some of her new programs, and some of them are brand new programs, permanent, including her own racial equity, or they're called equitable development initiatives, which were newly funded in this year's budget. Okay. Durkan also uses that money to fund programs formerly covered by the city's general fund so that she can free up and shift money out of the general fund to spend on her other priorities, including $115 million for the Regional Homelessness Authority and to boost funding for the Seattle Police Department. I'll talk about that in a minute. She also hijacks one-time funding from the federal government for COVID-19 relief and spends it on programs that will need permanent funding going forward from the general fund. And this is just really, really bad fiscal policy. She even spends COVID-19 relief money on her quote-unquote clean city initiative. And there's that clean city and cleanliness terminology again, which means that, yes, a lot of this money is going to be spent on sweeping homeless encampments, right? She also uses one-time COVID-19 relief funds for Green New Deal investments, practically ensuring that the new mayor and the city council are going to have to come back and scramble through and really look closely at the general fund to try to find permanent funding for those programs next year. And those are programs that do need to be funded with permanent funds, not COVID-19 relief funds. Durkin also submitted to the city council a separate piece of legislation that would lift the restrictions that the city council put on the Jumpstart payroll tax funds so that she and future mayors can use the money for whatever they want. And that's bad faith. Okay. The city council explicitly passed that tax as a progressive tax to fund affordable housing, lifting those kinds of restrictions on the Jumpstart payroll tax funds, would just go back on that promise of we're collecting this money to build housing.
So and that what exactly
people
is a higher
income levels can live in Seattle.
What exactly is a higher priority in the city right now other than building affordable housing? I don't think there is one.
I don't think there is either. Okay. And Durkin's rating of the Jumpstart payroll tax fund is very ironic, given that she refused to sign that bill when the city council passed it last year. She returned it to the council unsigned, so of course it went into law anyway. But she didn't support the tax. But now she's saying, okay, let me get my hands on all of it, you know, to use however I want. Okay, so this week.
There's a character in Lord of the Rings that it reminds me of.
Yeah.
A particular ring.
Oh, yes, yes. And it's, yeah. And
my
it's
precious.
Not one of the heroes. Okay, so this week, representatives from the various city departments started presenting their budget, their departmental budgets to the city council in a series of meetings and answering questions from the council members. And you can find those videos of those meetings on the city council website if you want to. I watched the presentation on the Seattle Police Department budget, so I want to talk about that for a few minutes to see if the council could pry open the black box of the Seattle Police Department budget, because the mayor's budget book, her printed budget, just didn't make much sense to me for the Seattle Police Department budget. It didn't have nearly enough detail to make heads or tails of it. And the overview that Seattle...
That's not an accident.
No, that's not an accident. That's the pretty typical for the police department budget every year. And last year and the year before, starting in 2020, the city council really started to try to pry open that black box and to get more details on the budget. And it looks like they're going to have to do it again this year, because the overview that Seattle Police Department personnel, and there were two representatives from the department as well as Chief Diaz in that presentation, gave the city council an overview on Thursday that was very high level and didn't have much detail at all, especially how much in salary savings is in the 2022 budget and where that money is being reallocated. And Lisa Herbold, as chair of the Public Safety Committee, had to ask them about it. One of the spokesmen from the Seattle Police Department told her that the total salary savings is about 18 to 19 million, and that she didn't have a breakdown to give her on where all of the salary savings was going, but that she would give it to her in a future meeting. So expect there to be more meetings with Seattle Police Department and the City Council. Now, the SPD is down about 193 officers from the beginning of 2020. And 9/11 response times are suffering as a result, particularly in a 2-year period when crime, particularly violent crime, has increased throughout the city like it has throughout the nation, particularly domestic violence and gun violence. And also things like drug overdoses have increased a lot over this 2-year period because of the COVID lockdown. It's just been so stressful for everyone. And some people respond to stress differently, and some people will act out violently. Now, even though the number of officers is down, the total 2022 budget for the Seattle Police Department is $2.5 million higher, and it's not clear what extra $2.5 million is for. Right? Given that there's all this salary savings that's being spent and reallocated on other things.
And if you believe the union, we're going to save a lot more money when the state's vaccine mandate goes into effect on October 18th and all the law enforcement people quit. They want the vaccine.
Yeah. Now, Mayor Durkin says that $2.5 million increase in the Seattle Police Department budget is for hiring 35 additional police officers. But then you'd have to say, isn't that what salary savings are for? Right? So Herbold asked about an analysis that was requested by the council, a risk assessment and a labor assessment, so that the 12% of 911 calls that both the city council and the executive, and by that she means the mayor, the police chief, et cetera, have agreed could be transferred to a civilian unit like Triage One, so that Seattle Police Department officers could be freed up to respond to calls for, about violent crimes, and that that should help 911 response times, right? Some of these nonviolent calls include things like littering, noise disturbances, and person down calls. There were, I think, 28 different types of calls in that category that both the city council and the executive, the mayor and the police chief, et cetera, agreed could be shifted, and representatives from the SPD agreed could be shifted to a civilian team. The answer is that no, the Seattle Police Department has not done that analysis yet. And the Seattle Police Department is asking for $5 million this year in technology funding to partially pay for that analysis, plus some other items that relate to the consent decree and a data analysis on racial equity in police responses to 911 calls, which really led me to think, you know, why haven't they been doing this already as part of the consent decree, you know? And then it came out that the 2022 budget for the Seattle Police Department as proposed by Durkin would also fully restore things that the council cut last year for a good reason. Things like event overtime, salary increases that, you know, most departments in the city had a cut in their salary increases, travel and training because people were not traveling because of COVID-19 and not doing in-person trainings, and discretionary purchases for things like furniture and some additional less lethal weapons that the department wants to purchase. Well, which led Herbold to ask, you know, before restoring funding 100% for all of these items, did the department base these amounts on any kind of analysis? Because, for example, you know, we don't have a lot of events going on in 2020 and 2021, and do they really expect all these events to start up like you know, Seahawks games and music festivals and stuff in 2022? And the answer from the SPD personnel was often, nope, we're just asking you to restore the full funding that we had before for those terms. We didn't, for those things, we didn't have any analysis done.
It's how it's always been.
Yeah.
We make up a number out of thin air and you give it to us.
Yeah. So Lorena Gonzalez asked some questions too. She was most interested in whether the new community service officers, that's the new civilian support team within the Seattle Police Department, are leading to any efficiencies in the department and freeing up SPD officers. The answer from the SPD representatives is that the community service officers are a great complement to what SPD officers do, and that they have a different skill set that works really well and provides a lot of support to Seattle police officers. And then the SPD representative kind of got really excited and said that some members of the community service officer team are now considering becoming sworn SPD officers, which led Lorena Gonzalez to ask about whether the CSO team was ready to be transferred into the new Community Safety and Communications Center, where the 911 dispatch team is now. So clearly you see the problem here, right, of the conflict. The council is trying to move work off of the plate of Seattle Police Department officers. But if the community services officers team is turning into a hiring pipeline for more police officers, that's not really accomplishing that goal, right? Teresa Mosqueda then asked if there was a written policy for how the CSO team members are deployed and in what situations. And the SPD spokesperson said that, yeah, there, he thinks there is. He's not sure, and he'll get back to her on that. So I think there's some concern on the council that the CSOs are being used as kind of a junior officer training program rather than as a real true civilian team to take the place of SPD in certain situations.
And you wonder about the mindset of some of these CSO officers if they're so eager to become SPD officers.
Yeah. And I think that's a concern too.
yeah, how you know, what kind of attitude they're bringing to their current role, which is not the same as a sworn officer at all.
So I think Gonzalez is really concerned about that. You know, what are the criteria for hiring CSO officers? What kind of training are they undergoing? You know, who's really in charge of them? And Mosqueda was concerned too about, okay, what role are they really playing? You know, in these, are they really people without a uniform who are there to de-escalate versus just being sort of I'm here to carry your radio and other equipment for police.
And I want to pretend I'm a cop.
And I want to also eventually become a cop. So also, Lisa Herbold asked if the new hiring targets for the department are reasonable. She pointed out that the 2021 budget initially estimated that only 85 officers would leave the department when attrition has historically been higher than that year after year. The 2022 budget assumes that Seattle Police Department will hire 125 new officers, and Herbold pointed out that the department has never exceeded 108 new hires in a year. And the SPD personnel answered her by saying that the department has now digitized a lot of the application process and background checks, which should allow them to do hiring at a faster rate. But I think we'll have to see if that's really true. So
that still doesn't answer the recruiting.
Really doesn't answer her
question.
Which
has been an issue for at least the last decade. Yeah.
Particularly the attrition question. They basically, the SPD representative basically said, well, you know, we think the people who hate this process of change in the Seattle Police Department have all left now. So attrition should be going down. And I don't think so. I don't think that's true. Yeah, I don't think that's true. So it looks like the council will be hearing again from SPD representatives, and they're going to have to keep pushing them for more details because as usual, the Seattle Police Department budget, as released by Mayor Durkin, was not informational at all. And
once again, it really, really, really matters who the next mayor is.
Yeah, it really
and
does.
Who the next police chief is.
Yeah. So we'll be keeping an eye on that in the coming weeks.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Okay. Let's talk about this week's pandemic-related news.
Yeah, and we don't have a lot of time left, so I want to get through it relatively quickly. We had a kind of a nasty incident down south of here in the area between Pierce and Thurston counties where the Nisqually tribe has its land. And for the last 18 months, it had been operating rather quietly, a retreat area with a bunch of outbuildings where it was housing tribal members who had to quarantine because of, COVID, either because they had been diagnosed with COVID or because they had been exposed to it. Now, this had not been particularly controversial in the local area around Roy, Washington, until recently. When some trees aligning the highway were apparently cut down, thus making some of the outbuildings visible. This started a bunch of rumors in the right-wing fever swamp that this was not Nisqually at all. This was the state's concentration camp for people who refused to get vaccinated. And this was accompanied by threats, vows to burn the buildings down. And so the tribe has now had to abandon that particular retreat center. This is a really, really discouraging and, and as well as, you know, racially, tinged, shall we say. And, underscores once again that the crazy that we're seeing in the rest of the country is alive and well in Washington State as well, unfortunately. The new case and hospitalization and death rates, locally and statewide are down slightly over the past couple of weeks. That's the good news. We'll see whether it is sustained, given that the weather is getting cooler and people are moving indoors now more and more. We'll see, you know, how much compliance there is with the state's mask ordinances and businesses requiring people to be vaccinated in order to enter. I don't have a lot of faith in businesses' ability to enforce that, and I feel really badly that underpaid staff members are being asked to enforce that when that shouldn't have to be their job. But those are the times we live in, unfortunately. So we'll see whether those numbers trend back up or not, or whether they continue to decline. I'm hopeful that they'll continue to decline. That is the national as well as the local trend, but we'll see.
Okay.
Did you have anything to add locally, Maria?
Nope.
Okay. Nationally, just today, the country reached 700,000 total deaths from COVID-19 over the past 20 months. Now, bear in mind, that is not quite the population of the entire city of Seattle died from COVID-19. And 300,000 of those deaths have come since the first of the year. That is to say, since vaccines have become widely available. And so 300,000 of those deaths were, with
largely avoidable.
Relatively few exceptions where they were preventable. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is just a tragedy of unthinkable proportions. The fact that it is not even a major news story and most people aren't even taking notice of it, really tells you how numb people have become to the suffering that this pandemic has engendered. We also saw this week, speaking of crazy people, that National School Board Trade Group asked the Federal Department of Justice for assistance in helping to protect elected school board members across the country who have been besieged not just with protests, but with death threats, threats to their family, things that no elected official should have to be subjected to, all because of school mask mandates, and that somehow impinging on your freedom to kill your kid, I guess. That really tells you how widespread this has become. We also saw some investigative reporting this week that a lot of those school board disruptions have been a coordinated campaign, and they have been funded by nonprofits associated with the Koch brothers. Now, what in particular is their interest in doing that, other than undermining public health measures and undermining Democratic elected officials who are trying to implement those public health measures? We're seeing in real time what the real life effects of that is, which is that it's killing people, and it's just not a good situation. We continue to have far more deaths, nearly 2,000 a day, than any other country in the world. Far more new cases, far more hospitalizations. Because with the possible exception of Brazil, you don't have an organized right wing that is resisting public health measures in the rest of the world. They're not controversial.
Science is not controversial in the rest of the world. It's only certain very, very wealthy people who don't want you to examine how they got their wealth and whether or not they deserve to have that money and to be using that money to support right-wing politics, who really want people to start to doubt whether or not science and vaccines can protect you from COVID-19.
The flip side of that is that we got a lot of evidence this week that vaccine mandates work, that we're seeing New York and California have now implemented it for all state employees.
Yeah.
We've got a number of large corporations that have implemented it for their employees, and it is causing people to go get vaccinated. The number of people who threaten to quit rather than getting a vaccine is vastly larger than the number of people who actually do quit because they need those jobs. So they get vaccinated. And that's the point of a vaccine mandate, is to get people vaccinated and protected.
Who have been kind of sitting on the fence. Once you tell them, hey, look, it's You know, the statement, it's your life at risk, doesn't seem to matter to them. But when you tell them it's your job at risk, then yeah. somehow it matters, unfortunately.
By the way, King County reached a milestone this week that didn't get a lot of attention. It has now reached 80% fully vaccinated of age 12 plus, which is really good news. It's much higher than most of the rest of the country. And it means that,
but we're still not there yet again.
No,
herd
we're not.
Immunity is, remember, herd immunity is 90 plus percent, and we still need to reach for that.
Yep. And we saw this week the application by Pfizer for emergency authorization for a vaccine for 5 to 11-year-olds, which would be a huge help to be able to get school-age children who are not currently eligible for a vaccine, get them vaccinated, or at least get a large percentage of them vaccinated. So that's the pandemic update.
All right. We have about 3 minutes left. Would you want to jump to national police-related stories or the House Select Committee?
Let's talk about the House Select Committee.
All right.
It's been very busy the last couple of weeks. Last week, it subpoenaed a couple of four very high-profile aides to Donald Trump, including Steve Bannon and former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. This week, it subpoenaed 11 additional people, and these are people who are sort of Republican Party functionaries who the committee is interested in finding out what their role was in planning the riot on January 6th, because it clearly was planned. It was not just a spontaneous event that that suddenly mushroomed out of control. This was planned. And, this, you can see that that's the direction that the committee wants to go. Now, a lot of these Republican recipients of the subpoenas have said they're not going to comply. So it's going to take a court process, and it's going to take a while to resolve, unfortunately. But you can see what the committee is interested in investigating, and that it is interested in investigating those things. And as we come up, we're like 3 months short of a 1 year anniversary of that event. And I would expect actually that there will be some additional right wing noise on January 6, 2022. It takes a long time to investigate this stuff, but the wheels of justice are turning, and they are turning within the Department of Justice as well. We're starting to see sentencing for some of the people who were originally charged, and it's been upwards of 600 people now who have been charged for their role in that riot, or insurrection, I should say. So that's continuing to move forward.
Alright. Well, with that, we're pretty much out of time.
Can I just mention an event?
Sure, go for it.
I hope it's still on today.
Yeah, today at 2 p.m. is the Rally for Reproductive Justice at Westlake Park.
Oh, yes,
at
thank you.
Fourth
thank
and Pine, you. Downtown. And so if you are as concerned as I am about abortion rights and women's reproductive rights, it's definitely worth checking out that rally at 2 p.m. today at Westlake Park.
And women's access to reproductive health care. I mean, that's
yes.
a big part of this, too. And the right wing is not content with banning abortion. They're going after contraception next. Mm-hmm. So, bear that in mind, because that was the Griswold decision of the Supreme Court, which is what they want to overturn, and which was a privacy decision that made contraception, modern contraception, possible, was the big change that allowed women to join the workforce. So that's what they want to take back next.
Yeah. And also to remind people that the new light rail line to Northgate
yes.
opens today
yes,
with
yes.
New stations in the U District, Roosevelt Neighborhood, and Northgate. So check that out if you get a chance. And also check your bus schedules if you live in North Seattle, because all of those are changing in North Seattle. So make sure you know where your bus goes and what times.
Yep.
All right.
And I mean, I've been watching that construction for a solid 5 years, and I can remember walking past the area where the U District light rail station is now in 2016 and seeing, construction. This will
yes.
be done in 2021, and thinking, what on earth takes them 5 years to build this? but it is now actually built and operational, and that's very exciting.
Operational, except already the university district has a escalator out on day.
Yes.
No, great.
Yes. Long-standing tradition that only part of the escalators work on.
Yeah, that, and, that and, you're going to have to climb some stairs.
Yes, and the elevators will be down for repair.